like our sense of spiritual malaise, in the first instance, that is carried in our bodies, not just in our heads. I mean, one has to understand that it's not useful to think of the psychological and as the mental, because mind and body are not two separate things. This is one reality. That becomes obvious just when you think about the last time that you were angry. How do you know you were angry? Well, just look at what happened to your face.
I'm Sadia Tariq, and you're listening to Thani, the podcast. I present to you one of the most finest conversations that I've had with Sheikh Ibrahim. And today he talks about spiritual malaise and healing. If you like the podcast, please share it with your families and friends. Thank you for listening. Sir, delighted to have you back on Thani. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, ma'am.
Sir, diving right in, as we briefly sort of exchanged messages, my question here is the healing. It's not even a question, but more of an idea, or the healing of our spiritual self. Of course, there's a lot of, psychologists and psychiatrists and mental disorders and trauma. There's a lot of talk on all these things where the mind and the body or the heart has received some sort of abuse. And then we have to sort of recover from that. But when we talk about healing on the spiritual self, what are we really saying? What are we talking about?
I'm of the view, I have the sense that to be a functioning human being among people requires us to be, cauterized. Our spirits need to be cauterized in a way. And that, in a sense, is doing violence to us. The process of our socialization takes this scintillating, bright, loose being that has just come freshly from the presence of the Rabb, and then, if you like, straitjackets that being into an identity. And that straitjacketing is a violence that gets done to the being. And that violence that gets done to our beings is necessary, because otherwise, I mean, that's the peculiar thing about human beings. If we're not socialized, we can't survive. We have to learn to be a person among people. But that process of socialization is also a process of, if you like, being cut off from our primordial natural selves. Mm-hmm. That is then also a cultivation of a state of dis-ease, because it's a cultivation of a state of neediness. And if you like, the spiritual journey can be seen as the journey of recovering that original state of ease, that original state of connectedness with our own.
So how does this dis-ease manifest itself? How does it show itself?
Anything that has within it a smell or a taste of rancor or of ill feeling and distrust. So if you think about the past and you mourn in any way, you have a sense of injury in any way, and you look into the future and you are fearful, you have a sense that the future is a dangerous place, and that you need protection from it. All of these are the fundamental attributes of the ways in which we get tamed into being useful to other people. I mean, we we are made to feel, we create the conditions where the person feels inadequate and needs protection, needs help. And that sense of inadequacy and that's kind of the source of all ailment, if you like. You overblow that and you can put that to the point where it becomes completely dysfunctional and you have something which you can describe as psychologically symptomatic. Mm. The person is just so riddled with ill feeling and fear that they become dysfunctional. But in a sense, all of us have it. Otherwise, we couldn't speak language. It's just that. So what I'm suggesting is that the difference between a normal functioning person in society and a person who's completely psychotic is not a difference in kind. It's a difference in degree. We all need to be psychotic in order to be a human being amongst people.
Does it sort of, as you said, there's an ill feeling, there's a tautness to certain situations that we feel, but would it sort of manifest itself in our physical being, or would it manifest in our body? Would it manifest in our actions or dealings with our relations? Is that possible?
I think all of the above has to be true. If we just look at it physiologically, I think it, you know, I don't know what the proportion is, but a huge proportion of ailment and of disease has a psychosomatic root. Our habits of thought, particularly our toxic habits of thought, are just blood chemically bad for us, and they produce illness. You even see it posturally. I mean, you know, people who get orthopedic problems, or they have bone problems because of the way in which they sit or walk. And the way in which they sit or walk is basically a physical expression of a narrative that goes on inside themselves. And that narrative is one, you know, whatever it is, it may be one of fearfulness. So the person is always hunched, but it may be one of rage. So the person is always taut and kind of tensed. Whatever it is, it's not physiologically good for one. So our sort of experience of our sense of spiritual malaise, in the first instance, that is carried in our bodies, not just in our heads. I mean, one has to understand that it's not useful to think of the psychological and as the mental, because mind and body are not two separate things. This is one reality. That becomes obvious just when you think about the last time that you were angry. How do you know you were angry? Well, just look at what happened to your face. It sat in your jaws. It sat in your hands. It sat in your shoulders. So the anger isn't just in your brain. The anger is carried in your entire body. Then also in terms of toxicity in relationships, I mean, all relationships become toxic when people try and manage each other. I mean, if you have a relationship with somebody who's constantly trying to get something out of you, they're trying to produce an outcome which is in their interest, they're manipulating you the whole time, that produces conflict in the relationship. Mm. So. And why would the person want to produce, manage you? Why would the person manipulate you? Well, it's because they don't trust that you will do or act in their interest. So they've got to make sure that you act in their interest. And so the manipulation is really a reflection of their fearfulness, of the toxicity of their way of looking at the world. So it's exactly as you say. I mean, we're one being. So my malaise, my spiritual kind of disease, has a physiological footprint, which eventually could become symptomatic, and in fact could become so symptomatic that it could kill me. But it also has an interpersonal footprint. It is reflected in the dysfunction or function, the disharmony or harmony in my relationships. And all dysfunction in relationships is based on people trying to manipulate each other. It's based on people trying to manage others in their own interest. And all health is rooted in the opposite. It is rooted in the people trusting that the other has their best auspices in mind and they don't have to manage the other.
So assuming that, as you said, that we all have a degree of we are psychotic, the degree varies. So, and again, of course, the journey really in this world is to, as you said, is to heal and go back to the way our Rabb, the genetic makeup that he's created us with.
Yes.
So what are some of the requirements or conditions or sort of, you know, how do we sort of lay the groundwork of the fact that, okay, I want to heal. So what are the pillars? What are the bricks? How do we lay the foundations of this house?
Our path is about an incremental reclamation of lost territory. At one point, we were fresh from the presence of our Rabb. And that has to mean that we were experienced an experience of deep bliss and of joy and of no need, no ill feeling, no lack. That was the case when we were born. Then, over time, in order to become useful citizens, we have been sort of socialized into basically operating a program that says, well, I have to be useful to others, otherwise I don't have a right to be. So I have to earn my keep. And so that initial sense of being a fulfilled being has to be turned into a needy being, a being that has to go out and get an education and get a job and provide. And because, you know, there's scarcity, there isn't the sense of primal abundance. And we all have, that's a necessary journey. That initial kind of alienation from our primal state is a necessary journey. Our path, however, is about returning to that state. So it's about finding the way back home, if you like. And just like we got, if you like, into an alienated state incrementally, the journey back is incremental. And in the first instance, on our path, we understand the journey back is to basically do those things that Allah describes as being those things that produce a state of and not having any fear and not grieving. Now, not having any fear and not grieving basically means that you have no rancor, you have no ill feeling, there's no grief, and you trust the future completely, and you therefore have no fear. That happens, first of all, on the basis of Salah. I mean, Salah is the cornerstone of this. But then it's also important how the Salah is done. You know, if you do the Salah in the spirit of if you like having to earn the good pleasure of the Rabb, that is still operating an architecture of intent that says I need to earn my keep. There's another way of looking at Salah, and that is that it's a way of abandoning your concerns in the lap of the Rabb. Because when you do that, when you say, listen, I mean, you know, you say to him in your Salah, you basically do your Salah in the attitude of, my life is more complex than what I can manage. Please take it from me. Please take the complexity from me. Please take the neediness from me. Please protect me. Please provide for me. If that is the sense of, if you like, a child coming back into the sort of the warm embrace of the mother, of the parent. If your Salah is done with that spirit, then what you will find over a period of time is that indeed you do start grieving less, and indeed you do start being less fearful. you do incrementally start having a greater and greater sense of being at ease. So practice is, in our path, practice is the incremental journey back home, where we had this incremental journey of alienation, the masala, the soam, all the things that we do are actually the incremental journey back home. That's the technology that we've been graced with as Muslims.
Indeed. Of course, the fact really is that we are inflicted. And every time there's a physical illness and we're inflicted, we just work suboptimally. And when there is, when we're inflicted with a spiritual illness, you're saying one of the very important tools that we have been blessed with is Salah.
Mm.
And so the idea really is that through prayer, we are trying to remove these subconscious blocks that are sort of hindering our road, our journey towards Allah.
You could see that. Because another way of understanding how our process of alienation has happened, how this layer is that it's in layers. And it's these layers are basically sort of, if you like, pronouncements of or if you like, convictions about how the world is. So maybe at some point you were deeply humiliated as a child for having not dressed properly, and as a result you've got this absolutely deeply ingrained sense of shame and that shame then haunts you throughout your entire life. But if you how does one then get beyond this sense of shame? Well, actually at some point you need to find the little person in you, the little girl who had been humiliated. And you need to revisit that experience and allow, if you like, that experience to be cathartic or cleansed.
Mm-hmm.
It is like that whisperer that sits inside you, that keeps on reminding you that you're a bad person. That whisperer, that point of whispering needs to be found and cathartic. And so this way of looking at our healing is a cathartic view of healing. It's saying that our ailment is almost like a pollution. It's a pollution that's been laid up in layers. Another way of understanding that pollution is that it's the things that get whispered in our beings, our convictions about the world that are not that don't reflect the truth that he is our Rabb, and that there's no reason to be fearful and there's no reason to grieve. So those messages that are being whispered, what happens is as we deepen our practice, those messages incrementally get quieter and quieter. Those whisperers stop whispering. And they stop whispering because you increasingly bring the light of attention of your consciousness down to the levels at which these convictions are operative. I mean, you must have had this experience that you have something haunting you for decades, and then you suddenly realize, but you know, this is actually I made a decision as an 8-year-old that I can't trust. I need to be careful in this sort of situation, and I now realize that I made that decision, and I forego that decision. I say it's no longer operative. The moment that happens, that ghost leaves you. Another experience of that ghost leaving you is like a veil lifting.
Mm-hmm.
One way of looking at this alienation is it's a laying up of veils, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Each one of those veils are sort of layered up. It's almost levels of whispering in your being. Inside you, there's from the very plummeting depths of your being up to your most conscious level, there's layers of internal dialogue going on an ongoing basis. Most of that internal dialogue is both inaccurate and actually a little bit toxic. What happens as you develop spiritually is that you operate from a deeper and deeper place in yourself, and you are operating from therefore a quieter place in yourself, and then many of these things that you say to yourself just no longer operate.
Yeah, but then how do we discern between the whispers and the truth?
As soon as it's whispered, it's untrue. So, there's a difference between your comment about a thing and your experience of a thing. We don't recognize just how deeply our experience is actually informed by our programming. So let's say, for instance, you have a really visceral fear of spiders. Because you had some traumatic experience of spiders as a child. Mm-hmm. I could get you in a state of terror just by having a reasonably convincing sort of plastic model of a tarantula sitting on your desk.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Now, there's nothing dangerous about the tarantula. But at the same time, there's nothing illusory about the fear. So how does that fear come? Why is it that you can be absolutely paralyzingly terrified of something which is, in a sense, an illusion? Well, it's because you've designated it as an illusion. So it doesn't matter what it is that we experience. Inside our beings, there's an interpretive step that we don't realize is happening, which designates something as dangerous, or benign or whatever.
Mm.
Now, the deeper you operate in yourself, the more you recognize that these decisions are being made. You see that there's a level of there's a thought that goes along with the stimulus.
Yeah.
Actually, fundamentally, the vast majority of things that happen to you are, but in fact, absolutely everything that happens to you is both benevolent and happens to you directly in your interest, because that is his promise to you. He said, am I not your Rabb? And is he not Rabb al-Alameen? And if he is Rabb al-Alameen, it means that absolutely everything, like a Rabb, is the custodian, the one who protects. Everything that happens to you is actually in your interest. So why then do you see things as being malevolent? Why do you interpret them as being dangerous to you? So while you aren't experiencing the world that you're in as your friend and your ally, then understand even the experience that you have is false. It's not true. Mm. It's the experience that you have is based on a thought. It's based on an interpretation. It's not the primary experience. Primary experience, if you're having a naked, absolutely naked experience of the proximity of the real, you can only be in an ecstatic state. There's no other possibility. So if you aren't in an ecstatic state, you're looking at a filter. And that filter is one that operates at the thought. So the moment you feel bad, no, there's something wrong going on here.
So taking the lead up from here, assuming that we're sort of making success and we are trying to sort of very carefully, very slowly climbing up the ladder, falling down the rungs and then climbing up again, or perhaps removing the wheels, or, you know, really, really working towards spiritual benefit. How do we assess our success? How do we know we're on the right path?
In a sense, the easiest barometer is, what does it feel like to be in your own skin?
Mm.
So if do you grieve and do you have fear? Do you have ill feeling? Do you think that the world has done you ill in? How morose do you get, and how fearful are you of the future? The degree to which that is no longer there. So what would be the opposite of grief? Would be gratitude, satisfaction. What would be the opposite of fear? It would be trust. So you have a barometer, an internal barometer. What does it feel like to be you? Are you try? Do, does it feel? Does is it pleasant to be in your skin, or is it unpleasant to be in your skin? Are you fearful in your own skin, or are you trusting in your own skin? Are you disgruntled, discontented, and resentful in your own skin, or are you grateful in your own skin? That's the first, that's the most profound tool to use. And you will find, if you commit to practice, that over a period of time, and it is incremental, it takes time, you have an increasingly pleasant experience of being in your own skin. Being alive is pleasant. It's pleasurable. It's no longer distressing. Most people find being alive actually quite distressing.
So essentially, there's a lot of inner engineering happening, and we have to sort of be quite awake, and ears and eyes internally have to be quite open to receive these signals, to assess and to understand if we are actually breathing, if we're angry, if we're frustrated, if we're generally happy with ourselves, as you said, feeling comfortable in our own skin.
That's true.
Which obviously requires a huge amount of being present.
The work that you do, inner work is the opposite of hard work. Inner work is lazy work. Inner work is letting go work. It's anti-work. It's non-work. You can't describe Salah as work. Salah is like an escape from the day. It's an escape from work. So that's one of the, you see that, I think it's one of the misfortunes of how people see the whole process of spiritual growth, is that they think it's the same kind of endeavor as ordinary work. Now you can say, look, I mean, if you don't commit to inner work, that you won't, that you'll get stuck. You're not going to grow. One can say that. But that's only half true, because the problem isn't with that word inner. The problem is with the word work. Inner work is not actually work. It's not about putting in effort to produce an outcome. It is the exact opposite of that, is let going of efforts to produce outcome. I mean, surely that's exactly what a dua is. Any dua, you're saying, Rabb, so I can't deal with this. Take this thing from me. I'm foregoing the outcome. I'm letting it in a far more intelligent set of far greater ingenuity than my own, which basically means to say I've taken my hands off the steering wheel. That's not work. That's non-work.
Yes, this false sense of control that we have. We think we're managing things, but we really aren't. You're right. We just have to acknowledge and understand that our hands were really never on the steering wheel.
That's right. Now, that doesn't mean to say that we need to act as idiots. I mean, you know, we have that wonderful hadith of the Rasul Islam, and we said, tie the camel. I mean, Bedouin came to him and said, does it trust in Allah mean I don't have to tie my camel? No, you tie the camel and you trust in Allah. In other words, you do the little bit that you can that's in your power, and then you forego the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Under the understanding that I've done the best I can.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it doesn't matter what I do, the best that I can is by definition inadequate, because it's the actions of a human being. And no action of a human being can be adequate.
Indeed. Indeed. However, sir, as usual, your conversation is always more than adequate, very, very expansive, and definitely so much food to chew on. Would you like to give us, say, the top three things before you really sort of close the conversation, which will enable us to lift the hand off the steering wheel?
Well, the most profound thing is really commit to your salah.
Mm.
And if you can, do tahajjud.
Mm.
And don't do your salah with the attitude of a grocer. You're not negotiating with the Rabb to get a better hereafter by standing on the masala.
So true.
Do your salah in the spirit of somebody who's you've come into the bomb shelter. You've come, the distressed and hurt child that's come home for the embrace of the mother. I mean, that's the Musalla is home. It is the place where you find refuge. Do your Salah like that. The second thing is commit to doing dhikr. You know, I mean, we know we're supposed to do dhikr, you know, standing, sitting, lying down. Increasingly, and dhikr isn't just the slapping of your tongue in Arabic. I mean, it means to remember that your Rabb is there. Remember that your Rabb is real. Remind yourself that whatever is in front of me is from my Rabb. And if it's from my Rabb, it's fundamentally in my interest and it's fundamentally good. No matter how unpleasant I interpret it to be. Just continue doing the dhikr. Continue to remember the proximity of your Rabb. And those are the two. I wouldn't want to complicate it with the third.
Indeed. And these two are colossal, as you said. So surely if we can even sort of remotely scratch the surface, staggering, we might sort of achieve radical results. So thank you. Thank you so much for your time. Always, always such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.